All right, well, I appreciate you all coming to class today, given what I put you through a little while ago. I don't think that was my easiest exam, but we'll wait till they're graded to see for sure. Hopefully it wasn't too frustrating, but oh well. I probably had more fun making it out than you had taking it. Okay. So now that we're through with that second exam, I just want to remind you that we're on the slippery slope to presentations. So, and presentations start not that far after Thanksgiving, in fact, because it'll be like three classes in from the last class, because we have six groups and two go per. And in fact, one of the things I need to do is to do a poll or something and get the groups assigned times so that we know when different groups go. So I've got meetings set up, or at least a discussion going with a couple of groups. So the other groups need to get in touch with me, so at least I can tell you, give you some heads up on a few things that might be helpful before you get going too much. Any questions on any of that? Okay. So I do appreciate you showing up. This actually, to me, is the lecture that's sort of the highlight of the whole class. We do some of the coolest stuff. We have to slog through a little bit of mud to get there. And I think I pointed out last time, the mud in and of itself is not really what I consider to be the course here. But I do want to drag you through the mud because I think it's sort of interesting. Plus, it becomes much more the point of the course in your next class, and so think of this as sort of a bit of an introduction to the vector calculus stuff, which will become mostly what you'll do in the next, as you move into upper level classes. So we last time defined a couple of new things using vector operators. One of them is known as the divergence, and you take the divergence of a vector field. And it's basically taking this vector operator that we've now seen a few times and doing the dot product of that with the vector field. And whereas the gradient gives you sort of the direction of greatest change in the field, the divergence gives you the degree to which the field emanates from or converges into a point. So a faucet would be, for a liquid problem, would have a very high divergence, for example. A point charge has a very high divergence for the electric field. A constant electric field. So the sign of the divergence tells you whether you're really converging or diverging. So positive divergence here, negative divergence here. This, if you have a constant field, the divergence is zero. So that should be sort of your intuition as to what the divergence means. A different vector calculus quantity that we'll use quite a bit is called the curl, which is the cross product of the del operator with the vector field. And you evaluate this in the way you would any cross product. And this gives you the degree to which the field circulates at a given point. So this would have a high curl. This would not have a curl if it's constant. And something which is it could have a very high divergence but have no curl, right? So if you're emanating from a point. So the electric field is going to have typically if you have an electric field from a point charge, it's going to have a high divergence but no curl, okay? So these vector operators are much more general than just electromagnetism. If you do fluid dynamics, you'll see them. Anything. These are pretty useful things that you'll see a lot of. And they can be, as we started to do last time, we began to manipulate them in and of themselves to do lots of things with them. So you'll see them a whole lot. Pedagogically, it makes a lot of sense to do Maxwell's equations in integral form. So that was sort of the first half of the class. And the problem is, from here on out, it makes a lot more sense to use the differential form. So we have to convert from the integral form to the differential form. And to do that, we take advantage of two vector calculus theorems, one of which is Stokes' theorem, which basically says the curl, which is the degree of circulation of the field, if you integrate it, if you take the curl and you dot it into the area over a surface and integrate that, then you basically get the sum of the extent to which the vector field circulates around the boundary of the surface. So that's sort of the intuition of what's happening here. Then Green's theorem is a bit different. This basically says if we look at the divergence of a field in a volume, it's going to be equal to the flux of that field through the surface. So again, if I took a mesh screen and put it around a source of water or at the end of a pipe, I'm going to have water flying, you know, coming through that as a measure of the flux. So the degree to which the water diverges is going to be the same as the amount of flux that's got to go through that surface. So that's sort of the hand-waving intuition for these two things. I haven't proven them mathematically, but we are going to use them. I have used them already. Okay, so last time, I mean, what we have then in the blue on the left-hand side are the four integral version, it's the integral version of the four equations that we know as Maxwell's equations. So this is Gauss's law, and then this is Gauss's law for the magnetic field. Because magnetism has no monopoles, this is equal to zero. Then we have Ampere's law, and Maxwell added this term, which is the displacement current, to take advantage of one geometry that we haven't seen before. And then this is Faraday's law. Okay. And so this is the integral form. We've played with those a lot. And now to convert them into differential form, we take advantage of using Green's theorem. And convert this form using this into del dot E is equal to rho. So this is a statement that you get a divergent electric field if you have a charge in that area, right? Because you have field lines that have to emanate from that charge or end on that charge. So if you have a net charge density, then that's what you're going to see. If you're in a region where there is no charge, then the divergence will be zero because the field will not be terminating or starting on anything. Okay, so that's the intuition here. You use the same theorem for the magnetic field and you end up with del dot B is equal to zero, but because there is no point charge for the magnetic field, it's zero. Okay. Here we use Stokes' theorem, and we find that del cross B is equal to mu zero times J times mu zero epsilon naught over the change in E with respect to time. And for Faraday's law, we use Stokes' theorem and convert it into del cross E is equal to the changing B field with respect to time. Just to give you a sense of what we're beginning to see here, these cross products, remember, contain a bunch of derivatives with respect to position here and here. This is a changing E field with respect to time, a changing B field with respect to time. So you're beginning to see that if I have a changing E with respect to time, I'm going to get a changing B in space. Changing B with respect to time, I get a changing E with respect to space, and those, of course, will be self-coupled. Okay? Now, The next step is to slog through the mud. To slog through the mud and see what these tell us. Okay? So that's where we're headed now. But we're going to take advantage of another something here. I'm going to want to define something called the Laplacian. And Laplace was a person, so this is a Laplacian. And the symbol is this del squared. So the thing is, it really makes sense from the point of view of if it acts on a scalar field, because you're taking the divergence of a gradient here, and you take gradients of scalar fields. So if we take this del and we dot it into the gradient, this then is del dot into the gradient of t, and remember the gradient is just basically how this operator operating on t, then this term times that term gives you the second derivative of t with respect to x, and I dot I is just 1. But this term times these terms is going to be 0 because I and J and I and K are orthogonal. So you end up with 3 terms, basically these second derivative terms, as the Laplacian. And this form turns out to be really useful, and you'll see it a lot. We're also going to use the Laplacian of a vector field, which is not really defined very well in the sense that you can't take gradient of a vector field, but the way in which it's defined is you are taking the Laplacian acting on a component of the vector field. So each of these terms actually contains only the component of the vector, the appropriate component. And so since this is just one component of the vector field x, this is a scalar. So you can operate on that. Okay. So these I'm just throwing out there because we're going to use them. All right. So I'd like to start in a region where we have no current. And I want to start with this equation. Okay, but because we have no current, then this term is 0 because we have no current, right? So the equation I want to start with is del cross B is equal to mu 0 epsilon naught times the derivative of E with respect to time. And then we're going to take the curl of both sides. So we have the curl of the curl of B is equal to mu 0 times epsilon naught times the derivative with respect to time of the curl with respect to E. The curl is a spatial thing, so we can pull it inside the time derivative here. And then this piece magically becomes without proof. I'll just save that bit of mud for you to do later in your career. Okay? And this piece then is what we've defined as the Laplacian of the vector field. Right? And the divergence of B here is 0. So this term is 0. All right, so what does that leave us with? We have... the Laplacian of B, where it's a vector, so that now is the left-hand side, that's all that's left, and that's going to be equal to the right-hand side, which is mu naught times epsilon naught times the derivative with respect to time of del cross E, but we go back to Maxwell's equations, del cross E is the negative time derivative of B. So the right-hand side of this becomes minus mu zero times epsilon naught times the derivative with respect to time of the derivative of B with respect to time, which is the second derivative with respect to time. All right. Now I hope, although you're hiding it well, I hope some of you are beginning to get very excited about this, because now this is beginning to look like something you may have seen before. You have a second derivative of a spatial thing, spatial derivative, and a second time derivative over here, and that's beginning to smell a lot like a wave equation, I hope, for you. Right? So, in B, now, one of the nice things about vector calculus, and it will get really, really, really bad. One of the things, actually, it's annoying in many ways. As you go up into your more advanced classes, you're going to find that your textbooks become smaller and thinner, and the titles become almost embarrassing. I had a textbook, it was like Introduction to Elementary Linear Algebra or something like that, right? It's like I was afraid to pull it out. People had no, you know, it's like, oh, wow, you're taking remedial algebra or something? It's like, no, I'm actually a math major. But the same thing will happen with the notation in the mathematics. What you're going to find is that the notation gets more and more compact, and it means, I mean, you can write down one little equation, and when you expand it out from what the notation tells you, you'll get this series of really complex things, and we're about to do a little bit of that. But Einstein's field equations that govern general relativity are written in this one little, you know, three symbol equation basically, and it's just simple. But when you expand it out, it's like 10 big nasty things. But so this is, remember, this Laplacian is really three different things. I mean, This is a vector. So we now really, it means this, it gives us an equation for each of the three terms of the vector. So this piece is actually equal to, we can take the x component for each of these and they have to be equal. So del squared of b in the x is equal to mu naught epsilon naught times the second derivative of B in the X with respect to time. And similarly for the other two terms. All right, so we actually have now these three equations, and now let us take just one of them and expand it. Remember, what is this del squared b? That is now the Laplacian of a scalar, which I will remind you is really gets expanded like this. So this is the second derivative of b in the x, because I'm using the b in the x equation here. That's the one I'm going to look at. I guess maybe it would make sense to do it. Well, never mind. Okay. We look at the change in b to the x in the x direction, the second derivative of that, plus the second derivative of the change in b in the x in the y direction, which may sound a little bit weird, but it could happen. You could have a b component in the x that changes as you move in the y direction. All right, so that's what that term is looking at. It's a second derivative. And then we have the third term, which is the second derivative of b to the x in the z direction. And all of this is equal to the second time derivative of b in the x. You all right with this? Okay. That's all you need after turning your brain to mush this morning. All right. So we're blowing things up for now, and we're going to make some simplifying assumptions in a few minutes to sort of get rid of some of this stuff. But this basically is a wave equation in B, right? And you have now three of these. This is one of those three equations. You have a similar equation for this y and a similar equation for this b. So we have three really nasty equations right now for b. So similarly, remember where we started. We started with the equation del cross B is equal to this time derivative of E. All right? And if we look back up at Maxwell's equations, so we started with this one, we have a very similar equation here. So we can do all the same stunts to this equation that we just did to this equation. And we don't even have to constrain it to be in a current-free region. So we're going to start with del cross E is equal to minus the change in B with respect to time. And then we do all the same steps, and we end up with the Laplacian of E, the vector Laplacian, is equal to mu 0 times epsilon naught times the second derivative of E with respect to time, which I can expand. So we just wrote down the E version of this, which can expand just like we did here. All right, so now we have six nasty equations in E and B. But these are different. I mean, the thing I want to show you is that here we're mixing E and B, so it's a little hard to see what's going on in here. But now if we... now we're actually creating two different equations, one in E and one in B. And earlier we had, just to remind you, Okay. So, way back when, if we were to look at a one-dimensional wave propagating in X, an equation for that, so it's like on a string with a vibration in Y. Okay, so you can go back to your mechanics if you don't remember this, and this is basically a fundamental wave equation where the wave is traveling along the X direction with a velocity V. Okay? So what we have here basically is a wave equation in B and a wave equation in E. Okay? Traveling with a velocity that is one over the square root of mu zero times epsilon naught. You okay with this? Calculate that number. And it's not zero. Don't know why I did that. It's actually the speed of light. Right? So out from Maxwell's equations pop wave equations in E and B, and these waves propagate out at the speed of light. And we're going to look at these, we're going to put boundary conditions and look at the exact form of these things. But you can get a sense of what's going to happen here, because if I have a changing electric field, it says that I get a changing B in the space around it. So you induce a B field. If you have a changing B, you induce a changing E field. So if I have a handful of charge and I create a changing electric field by moving them, it will create a changing B field, which will create a changing electric field, which will create a changing E field. And this self-coupled phenomenon will propagate out at the speed of light. And that is light. Okay? That is the essence of light. And all I have to say is it must have been one of the most magical moments ever experienced by a member of the human race when Maxwell figured that one out. I mean, can you imagine how cool that must have been to have figured that out the first time and realized it? I mean, I looked up his some of his comments early on. He actually, at the time, was thinking that the light was propagating in a medium. But, he did connect all of a sudden that these waves are actually light. That's just amazing. So it's a very cool thing that's tied up in here. So what I want to do now is to look at this, sort of imposing some boundary conditions. So Maxwell's equations are generally true, okay, period. What we're now going to do is to look at very particular situation. We're going to imagine that I'm going to place some constraints. I'm going to assume certain things about the orientation of the E field and the B field and how far away we are. And I'm going to then look at what happens with the waves so that we can get a basic intuition and feeling for these light waves. It's more general than just light because, but we'll get there, I guess. At any rate, just know that Maxwell's equations are quite general and that we're about to make a bunch of assumptions to build some intuition about what they have within them. But you need to learn to be a little bit careful about that intuition, because if you violate the boundary conditions, the waves that you end up with may look a good bit different from what we're about to do. But I think this will serve you well as a place to start. And one of the things you do in other classes might be to look at the more different cases. Okay. So what I'd like to do is to assume that we have some source of light and that we are very far away. And so, you know, here we are checking this whole thing out. Okay, but we're now very far away. And I want to, because we now have a lot of terms and a lot of equations, I want to not just let things be completely general. I want to say, let's just try to simplify things a little bit. Why don't we assume that let's assume we're in a Cartesian coordinate system. And the electric field is going to be a function of x and t. You say, why? Just because. I'm just basically going to say that that the electric field is a wave and it's going to propagate in the x direction toward me. Okay? And you're going to get really tired of hearing these words over the years. We're going to call these imposed things that we're doing to constrain the equations boundary conditions. And when I was in graduate school, I had an amazing professor who did a lot for electromagnetism, and he talked about boundary conditions, and so we mimicked him so much when I was in graduate school that I have a really hard time saying that term without actually just mimicking him. I mean, it's just habitual. So if it comes out, I am sorry. Okay, I mean, it was terrible. He was great. He was also fun to mimic. But anyway, okay, we're also going to, so this is a boundary condition, right? And then we're also going to assume that we have no charge in this region of space. So rho is going to be equal to zero. And that's where we're going to start. And I think I'll impose one or two more as we go. But let's just see what this says. So del dot E is equal to rho over epsilon naught. So that's a differential form of Maxwell, one of Maxwell's equations. Rho is equal to zero. Therefore, del dot E is equal to zero. Del dot E is the partial derivative of E in the x with respect to x plus the partial derivative of E in the y with respect to y, plus the partial derivative of E in the Z with respect to Z. But E is only a function of X and T. Okay? So E cannot be changing with respect to Y or with respect to Z. So these two terms are zero. Okay, and the reason for that is that, all right. right? Because I have imposed the condition that E is a function of X and T only, these terms are zero, and that means the partial derivative of E and the X with respect to X is equal to zero, which means E is constant in that direction. And first, I think we'll just impose that E in the X is equal to zero. Right? It could be non-zero, but we're just going to call it zero. E in the Y or E in the Z might be non-zero. Right? I don't have information on that yet. So this may sound, let me get the picture here. What follows from this is that E in the X is zero. So in terms of E's variation, it's all going to have to be transverse to the direction of propagation. It isn't changing in the direction of propagation. We're choosing it to be zero because we basically can choose whatever. E in the Y or E in the Z may change. Now, this may sound a little bit funny because E is a function of X and T. E is a function of X and T, but it might have a value in the Y or the Z. That value may change as a function of X. It's not going to change as a function of Y or Z. So if I have E in the Z non-zero, okay, it is that way throughout this plane in the Z and throughout this plane in the Y. Okay? It can be non-zero, and it can change as a function of X, but within this plane, it's all fixed. You okay with that? Okay, so the big statement here is that E is transverse to the direction of propagation. All right. Now we have del cross E is equal to the negative time derivative of B with respect to T. So that's one of Maxwell's equations. If we take the cross product and evaluate it, we get three terms, one in the I, one in the J, one in the K. The right-hand side is a vector, so it also has an I, J, K piece. So the I piece on the left-hand side and the I piece on the right-hand side have to be equal. And the same for the J, the same for the K. So this equation is equivalent to three equations. I promised you some mud, right? And we could do this more slowly, but if you understand that the curl has these three components and the other side has the three components, you can set each of the components to each other. And then the third equation you do a lot of this, you begin to appreciate the notation for the vectors and stuff, but if you want to see what's going on, you have to break it all down. Okay, so this This piece is fairly straightforward. I'll have the B in the X for the I hat piece, the B in the Y for the J hat piece, and B in the Z for the K hat piece. And that's what you see for the first, second, and third equation. And on the left-hand side, I'm taking out the I-hat piece for the curl, and the J-hat piece for the curl here, and the K-hat piece for the curl here. Okay, so right now it just looks very nasty, and to try to get something going on, to figure out what we can say, remember that we have imposed the fact that E is equal to a function of X and T, and we have figured out that it has to be transverse, and we're going to impose the boundary condition that it is transverse and in the y direction. So it's going to be in the j hat direction. So here is sort of another boundary condition. It's building a little bit off of what we've already learned. We've already learned that it is transverse, and we simply choose to have its direction to be along the y. Okay? The direction of the electric field in the transverse plane to propagation is known as the polarization. Okay, and we'll come back to that. So this thing, this one equation, is equivalent to all of these. And these are now fairly nasty. So let us see what we can learn because of this boundary condition. E is a function of x and t only, and it is along the j direction. So E cannot change as a function of y, so this term is zero. E cannot change as a function of z, so that term is zero. E cannot change as a function of z, so this term is zero. E cannot change as a function of y, so that term is zero. So this term, and that term all go to zero for the same reason. We have said that E is going to be in the J-hat direction, we made a choice, which is our boundary condition, and that means there is no Z component for E. So this term is zero. Okay? So that really leaves us with two equations that make sense. So this equation tells us that the derivative of B in the X with respect to time is zero, which means B in the X is constant. The second one here tells us that B in the Y is also constant. And the third one here tells us that B in the Z is time dependent, because this is not necessarily zero. Okay? And we can basically choose these to be zero for the same reason as some constant, so it's sort of not interesting. This one, this tells us that the B and the Z is non-zero and is changing in time. So this is now time dependent. B field. And it's perpendicular to the electric field, because we've chosen the electric field in J. If the electric field is in the Y direction, the B field is in the Z direction. It's propagating in the X direction. Okay? So we've now shown that B is also transverse, and it's at 90 degrees to E. You okay with that? All right, so with these assumptions, what we find is that E and B are both transverse, and are mutually perpendicular. All right? So you can picture this wave, in a sense, in the same way that you have pictured transverse waves on a string, right? And the wave equations solve the same way. So we know, actually, that we'll have a harmonic function. And you could have a wave that is not harmonic, but if you don't know it yet, you will learn it soon. You can take any shape wave and think of it as a sum of harmonic functions. So we only need to worry about a harmonic solution. Okay, you can have even a single pulse and describe it as a sum of harmonic functions. So we're not going to worry about non-harmonic shapes. But if we solve the wave equation, we now have some constraints. We said that E is in the Y, it's a function of X and T. So if I want to write down an equation for that, E in the Y is non-zero, and it's a function of X and T. We've said nothing about amplitude of the electric field, so we'll just assume that we have some initial amplitude for the electric field in the Y direction, and that it has time and spatial variance, and the spatial variance is only in X. So we're going to pick a harmonic function, so I'll just choose a cosine, and it has both a spatial piece and a time piece, and we'll throw in an arbitrary phase angle, which determines the initial condition. At x equals 0, t equals 0, the phase determines what the electric field is. Okay? If we freeze time, or we freeze the problem at some particular time. Let's choose time equals 0. Let us assume for the moment the phase angle is 0. Then this is cosine of kx. What you see is how the wave changes as a function of position. If it's harmonic, then whenever k here is an integral multiple of 2 pi, you have to come back to where you were. So K is known as the wave number, and I hope you've actually seen this stuff, 2 pi over lambda. Okay? If I go one wavelength, I have to come back to where I was. So that's what we mean when we say it's harmonic in space. Similarly, if I wait one period, if we sit at x equals 0 and we set the phase angle equals 0 and we just wait in time, every time we wait one period for this wave, then we will have to come back to where we were. So this piece, omega, is the frequency of the wave. It's 2 pi over the period. K is often known as the wave number. And this is also called, this is the frequency. You're happy with that? So for the moment, I'm just going to set this phase angle. This sets, just basically sets the initial conditions. So you assume, you know, x equals 0, t equals 0. What E is determined by the phase angle. And we're just going to set to 0 for the moment, just for simplicity. Okay. If we say that this is what E in the Y is, this is the relationship between E in the Y and B. So this equation now tells us what the solution for B has to be. So B in the Z is going to have to be the integral with respect to time of this quantity. E in the Y is this, so I know how to take the integral of that with respect to time. You get a sine. So B in the Z is equal to the integral of, and when you take the integral, you have to, you have to take this derivative first. So you take the derivative of this quantity, you pull, with respect to X, you pull the K out, and this becomes a sine. So we're taking the integral of K E0y sine of kx minus omega t, and I dropped the phi because I set it to 0 earlier, dt. So B in the Z, you can take the integral of the sine as the cosine, and we have to pull out, because we're now taking the derivative with respect to time, we have to pull out this omega that multiplies the time. So this is k over omega E0y times the cosine of kx minus omega t. You okay? K over omega is 2 pi over lambda over 2 pi over tau, a t, which is the period. That's the period divided by the wavelength. Wavelength divided by period is how far the wave goes in one period. So that's the speed of the propagation of the wave, right? And the time it takes for the piece on the string to go up and come back down and back to where it was, that's one period. And in one period, the wave will go one full wavelength. So you take that full wavelength divided by the period, you're going to have the velocity of propagation of the wave. So this is just equal to 1 over c. So we end up with b in the z is equal to 1 over c e in the y in terms of magnitude. So So where are we now? We find that E and B are coupled and time dependent. They are mutually perpendicular. The magnitude of E at every point is C times the magnitude of B. Also, and this is pretty important, note, remember phi is 0. This phase for the electric field is exactly the same as the phase for the magnetic field. So they're in phase and time dependent. So if E is big, B is big. If E is small, B is small. both time and space. Okay? It's sort of hard to see what this is really telling you. Fortunately, Maxwell may have seen this first, but the poor guy did not have what we have, which is my Java applet. You'll love this one. First, I have to find it. Okay, here. Probably there. All right. This is what we just found mathematically. E is red. It is along the y direction. It varies as a function of time, just for the moment. Only look at what E is doing in the yellow plane. So we fix space, the spatial coordinate to be x equals 0. E here, this green thing, varies harmonically along y, okay? The magnitude of this is going to be bigger than b. That's not shown so well here, okay, by this factor c. So E does this. This vector, this wave is not confined to this harmonic shape, okay? It is not a beam. That vector that you see here represents the strength of the electric field throughout this yellow plane, which is infinite. Okay, we call it a plane wave. And so this is probably the most deceptive piece of this picture, is it is not confined transversely. So this vector is the electric field. Right now, the electric field is very strong in the positive y direction throughout that plane. It's transverse to the direction of propagation. The B field is transverse and mutually perpendicular. It is perpendicular to E, and we haven't seen it yet, but E cross B is going to be the direction of propagation. We've actually already seen if E is in the Y, then B is in the Z. Okay? So if E is in the Y here, B is in the Z. When E is small, B is small because they're completely in phase. When E is big, B is big. Okay? And the thing propagates out. If I have if I change the frequency, right, the wavelength has to change as well. Okay? I can freeze time. Oops. Okay? I can freeze time. And then we can look at how the electric field varies with space, and the magnetic field varies with space. So as I go a full wavelength, right, I come back to where I was. So if I were to freeze time, what we would have for this wave propagating out, if I assume it's propagating in x toward you, okay, at the, let's say there's zero, so you have a full plane, infinite plane, both directions, where the electric field and magnetic field are zero, okay? And now, as I walk toward you, okay, then I would measure E going up, you know, B getting stronger, Now they're both completely strong, where I'm standing now, fully in this plane, right? If I keep walking along the wave, then they're going to get weaker and weaker. They're zero, and then they start to go the other way, right? So you can mimic it and do the whole. I'm probably much better at that because I grew up during disco years. But I'll try to give you some practice on this in one of the workshop problems. So, yeah. Okay. Go to a lower frequency, right? Now, the thing is, there's nothing in this that constrains the frequency. So we can have an extremely broad range of frequency, in fact, as broad as you would like, from nothing up to the size of the universe, okay? I mean, there's... So you can, in principle, have waves that have very different wavelengths. Now, your eye is only able to see a tiny bit of that, right? So it's a very rich thing that Maxwell discovered here. Your eye sees only a tiny, narrow range of these so-called electromagnetic waves. So this is electromagnetic radiation or electromagnetic waves. That's sort of the more general term that's inclusive for everything. Light is actually a term that we, in this course, we will use very loosely, but it really means typically visible light, which is that which your eye is sensitive to. Okay? And I do have some sort of graphic somewhere that's good for that. The most recent place that I remember where I have that would be... Something like this. So depending on the wavelength, you can have very different stuff. The wavelength, this is in meters, which I conveniently didn't write down. I guess I've got it here. So visible light is this tiny narrow range at about, this is 1 micron or 1 micrometer, okay? The human hair is on the order of 100 microns, 150 microns. So you're a good bit smaller than that. I mean, a good bit smaller to get the visible light. Atoms around 10 to the minus 10, nuclei around 10 to the minus 15 meters in size. But in terms of the different portions of the electromagnetic spectrum, we have visible light. If you go up in energy a little bit, we haven't really talked yet about the energy and how it varies with the wavelength, but as you go up in as you go down in wavelength, you go up in frequency, which goes up in energy. And so as you go up in energy, you get ultraviolet light, X-rays, gamma rays, and there's no end to that. As you go smaller and smaller, you have more and more energetic gamma rays. You can go up this way to infrared light, microwaves, radio waves. Now, the beautiful thing about this is because these wavelengths are, I mean, and quantum mechanics comes into this, but the wavelengths being so different means that these different wavelengths interact with matter in different ways. And that's the richness of the spectrum, which you can use. I mean, you already know this. You can use X-rays because they basically penetrate through material a lot more easily than visible light does. Radio waves can go through buildings rather nicely, right? But visible light might not so well. So you can do a lot of interesting things with this stuff, but the message here is that from gamma rays to X-rays, infrared light, microwaves, radio waves, and visible light, fundamentally, from a classical electromagnetic point of view, they are all the same thing. There is no difference. Okay, it's just how they interact with matter that you may have to deal with in a lot of ways. But this is known as the electromagnetic spectrum, okay? And the Maxwell's equations basically govern all of this. So it's very rich. Any questions or comments on any of this? Okay. So yes, I do urge you to go and play with those online. I reached a good stopping point. I want to now talk about energy flow in the electromagnetic waves, but it'll probably take me longer than the 5 minutes I've got. And probably your brains are mush today. Stephanie? The acceleration is a change in time. If I have a charge and I accelerate it, I'm going to be changing the electric field in the space around it. And so that will lead to radiation. That is a way to do it, yeah. Formally, the formal study of actual radiation and its dependence on acceleration, everything, we actually aren't going to get into. But the sense of it is, if I have a changing electric field, which I would get if I accelerated it, then you will get, you'll have to get something propagating. So, sure. And yeah, I think I did say that glibly at some point. But okay. All right. Have a good one.
In my heat mass transfer class, we're talking about radiation, you know, as emitted by a black body, and it said that.